She wants a man with lots of money, not a poor boy. He buys her things, she calls him honey. She calls me poor boy. What good could it do to give her love?
Okay, so I'm here with Timothy Noah, who is most recently the author of The Great Divergence. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad. Do you feel particularly divergent today?
Or? I'm no more divergent than usual.
Okay. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and start off. I think a good point to start off and to explain what The Great Divergence is to point to the infamous 1984 Morning in America ad, the most successful ad possibly ever, as you point out in the book. 1984. 2 years after the greatest rise in unemployment since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
This leads me to ask, how can the American public continue to be suckered into such panacea when income inequality continues to remain this very serious issue? And maybe we can also define what the Great Divergence is and how we got here.
Right.
Just to start off here.
Well, back in 1984, when Reagan aired his Morning in America commercial, people still hadn't quite figured out that incomes were growing steadily more unequal. It was a pretty early trend, and until really the mid to late 80s, economists thought this is some sort of weird blip, because what they had understood under the economic theory of Simon Kuznets,
yes,
Nobel Prize winner, was that here's what happens. Societies grow less equal during periods of rapid industrialization.
Sure.
The Industrial Revolution created a great deal of income inequality as we moved from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy. But then, as the industrial economy matured, you saw a move towards greater equality of incomes. That's what was happening in the United States. It was also happening in Europe. And so Kuznets thought, this is just the way it works. He didn't put it quite this way, but the thrust of what he was saying was, it's a mark of being a civilized nation.
Sure. Well, you also bring up the decline of the bank teller as one example of the moderately skilled workforce being hollowed out. Yet earlier this year, in Obama's State of the Union speech, he did call for a national commitment to train 2 million Americans with skills that will lead directly to a job. Is closing the skills gap, which seems to be the big liberal point, I mean, is this really going to solve the jobs problem? I mean, especially when computer technology, as you point out, changes so fast that it often eliminates entire job sectors, ergo the whole bank teller thing. Why do you think closing the skills gap remains this democratic position for a problem that requires, to some degree, I would say, unskilled or moderately skilled workers to have a job right now?
Well, that would be great to give them a job right now.
Yeah.
And I think part of what I do talk about in my book is that the government ought to have a jobs program and
yes,
bring back the WPA.
Sure.
For a number of people. I think the government has lots of low to medium skilled work that needs doing. We certainly need a lot of infrastructure repair and a number of other things. We're not very good at providing child care to welfare mothers who we force into jobs and so forth. But I do think that the skills gap is important. It's what you see in the United States is that the high school graduation rate, which rose and rose and rose through the first half of the 20th century, was able to meet the growing demand for skilled labor as technology, we had rapidly growing technology, especially in the early part of the 20th century. And the schools were producing more and more high school graduates to meet that demand. Then in the 70s, you see the high school graduation rate decline and then level off. And demand just kept growing and growing and growing. The sort of technological advance didn't stop. And so that bid up the price of skilled labor. And so that's part of the problem. So part of the solution, I do think, is to improve schooling in all sorts of ways, to increase the high school graduation rate, to improve vocational education. I also come out in favor for universal early education, preschool education. You know, one of the reasons we saw such a big increase in high school graduates in the first part of the 20th century was there was something that was literally called the high school movement.
Yeah.
Most people the overwhelming majority of people in 1900 didn't go to high school. And those high schools, there had to be political pressure that built up to build high schools, to get states to fund high schools, and to make attendance in high schools mandatory. And I think that something like that needs to be recreated for kids age 3 and up.
But how can it be recreated when you, in fact, even quote Richard Vedder in this, telling the New York Times, in 20 years you'll need a PhD to be a janitor? I mean, how much should education, in fact, be responsible for the economy's failings? I mean, college tuition, as you point out, relatively stable from the 1940s to the 1970s, roughly around the time when you had this period of prosperity. Are there any studies which suggest perhaps that removing financial barriers to education would create enough of a middle class through a jobless recovery, perhaps, that would improve the economy? What of this?
Well, I think that I certainly think that college has been priced out of reach for a lot of middle-class people, and I think that one of the things I call for is government price controls on tuition increases. When I wrote that, I thought, wow, this is really radical. Yeah. People are going to think I'm nuts when I propose this. Then I sent my manuscript off to Bloomsbury, and a couple of months later, President Obama gave the State of the Union address, and he was proposing something rather like that. I do think you're going to need a more educated workforce, but you know, there is a big debate right now over the degree to which income inequality is caused by a skills gap or by the run-up in incomes at the very top. And I think it's a silly debate because the income, if you're going back three decades, the income inequality growth is attributable to both.
Yeah.
Over the last 10 years, it's been attributable more to the run-up in incomes at the top. But we haven't seen any narrowing of the what's called the college premium. And now the college premium has created a graduate school premium. So you need to address all of these problems at the same time. The so-called 1% versus the 99% that we've heard a lot about from the Occupy Wall Street movement, that is really about two fairly simple things. One is the run-up of incomes in at the top of non-financial corporations, CEO pay spinning wildly out of control. And the other is the financialization of the economy in general. Finance is kind of eating the economy. You've got a much less regulated financial sector that has managed to create vast fortunes for a number of individuals while socializing and collectivizing losses because banks get to be too big to fail. And you know, we really couldn't let the banks fail in 2008. It would have caused a worldwide depression. But I think that one way to address that problem is to not let banks get that big in the first place.
Sure. Well, if much of this, as you were saying earlier, is a silly debate and we can't, in fact, go decades before, I mean, you know, this kind of returns to my initial question. Why can't Americans stare these problems, stare this income inequality, and stare this jobs problem straight in the face?
Well, you mean why aren't people willing to recognize that this is a problem?
Why can't we be realist about this, yeah? Instead of believe in some sort of pipe dream of the American dream.
Right, right. Well, people have started to pay more attention to it. I think there's more attention given now to the income inequality issue than there has during the 33 years that this has been a trend.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, when I talk about the Great Divergence, I am talking about an increase in income inequality. A lot of people say, well, Ari, do you think that everybody should earn the same amount of money? And, you know, of course I don't. You can't have a capitalist system without some inequality. But it is equally true that we don't need levels of inequality like we have in the United States today. We didn't used to have them. And during the post-war period, after World War II, really from 1934 to 1979, incomes were growing steadily more equal, as I said before, to the point where economists thought this is just the way it works.
Sure.
And in the post, we don't want to relive the Great Depression or World War II, but in the post-war years, we saw phenomenal economic growth, and we also saw movement towards greater income equality, or either that or a stable relationship between income growth for those at the top and those in the middle. And so it is certainly not writ in stone that you need inequality to have economic growth. And I think a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. What about overseas jobs? I mean, two-thirds of all the people who made or sold iPods in 2006, as you point out in the book, were located overseas, most in production jobs. One of your solutions in the what to do section at the end is to import more skilled labor. What of these Apple production jobs? I think I'm returning to what we were talking about earlier about the difference between skilled labor, unskilled labor, and moderately skilled labor. Surely there needs to be some sort of infrastructure in place, some perhaps patch until we actually get to this sort of great skills gap solution, which we seem to be talking about. I mean, it just seems to me that we're trying to fight a very difficult problem with a form of idealism that is just incompatible with that reality.
Well, it's hard. It's very hard to compete globally for low-skilled jobs because you know, it's a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
You end up in engaging in wage competition with some of the poorest countries in the world, and that's not going to make anybody prosper. If you look at a country like Germany, they've managed to hang on to their manufacturing sector, but the way they've done it is they have gone after highly skilled manufacturing jobs. And, of course, they also have a much more healthy labor movement here in the United States. We've had the labor movement has been decimated. They're down to now 7%
sure.
of all employed workers. So another part of the solution is to rebuild the labor movement. I'm not saying that it's going to be easy to address these problems, but in talking about ways to address them, I decided there was really little point in pretending that tiny little solutions were going to do much. I think it's time to start a discussion about some of the more ambitious things we could do.
But as you also note, if you have a job that you can perform from home, it's worth asking yourself whether an English speaker could perform the job tolerably well from halfway around the world at 1/30th the pay. Do you think that America has the obligation to give everybody a job, that that might actually be the solution in some way? Or do you think that the labor force really needs to revert to its inherent skills or skills that actually it could acquire to get those jobs? I think I'm trying to sort of get an answer from you in terms of whether it's actually the corporation's fault or whether it's education's fault or whether it's the people who are unskilled, whether it's their fault.
Well, I don't know whose fault it is per se. I mean, I think that our workers need to acquire those skills one way or another, anything we can do to encourage that would be good. But offshoring is a real problem. Although interestingly, the projections from here forward are that offshoring will have a bad impact on our economy, but it won't continue to have probably a very bad impact on income inequality. And that's because those other countries are now coming after the skilled jobs.
Yes.
It will be very interesting politically to see how that plays out. You know, there are a lot of affluent people who, when you talk about other countries eating our lunch in manufacturing, they say, well, we need free trade. You have to have capital flows across borders. Otherwise, we won't have prosperity. Well, I wonder if they'll still be saying the same thing when suddenly you have, for example, American radiologists competing with radiologists overseas. You've already got a bit of that.
Yes.
And, you know, there are any number of very highly paid jobs that could be performed off-site. And Alan Blinder, an economist at Princeton, he says he actually thinks that slightly more of the offshored jobs of the future will be skilled rather than unskilled.
Wow. In 1971, Lewis Powell wrote a memo. The American economic system was under attack from communists, new leftists, and other revolutionaries, as well as perfectly respectable elements of society. So this memo results in this tremendous flurry of pro-business lobbying from organizations and so forth. Various consumer-oriented laws are killed through this effective lobbying. And that was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pro-business lobbying today is arguably more pronounced than them. You point out in the book the figure that the Chamber of Commerce spent $132 million in 2010. As you point out, not a single labor union could be found among the top 20 lobbyists. So how then can any pro-labor organization make a serious dent with these particular states? I mean, what hope is there for like a modern-day Walter Reuther in this post-Taft-Hartley age?
Well, it is true that the corporate power in Washington is vastly increased, and it increased not just because of the Powell memo, but really throughout late 60s and 1970s, you had corporations absolutely flipping out at the rise of the regulatory state and counterculture politics.
Yeah.
And Ralph Nader. One person I write about in the book a great deal is Bryce Harlow.
Yes.
Who is best known as a White House aide in the Nixon White House, where he was kind of a good guy. He was trying to keep Nixon honest. Failed at that, but he was considered one of the few honorable men in the Nixon White House. That's all true. But he had a separate role where he spent most of his career post-1960, and that was as the Procter & Gamble representative in Washington, D.C. In 1961, when he came to work for Procter & Gamble, there were just a handful of corporate representatives in Washington, D.C. And Harlow looked around and thought, We need more troops here. And he started going around the country and evangelizing and giving speeches saying, we need to build up corporate power in Washington. And one of the things I really like about Harlow is that he didn't mince words. He identified the enemy as a movement towards greater equality.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say, well, what does the rise of corporate influence in Washington have to do with equality? Well, Harlow himself made the connection, and he succeeded, and Lewis Powell, who wrote that memo in 71, succeeded. Over time, the corporations were bestirred to increase their presence in Washington, increase their lobbying, and they get a lot more done, actually, through lobbying than they do through campaign contributions. As a result, you saw a change in our politics. It hurt the consumer movement, and it hurt the general movement towards greater equality. So that makes the task a lot more difficult, but I think, you know, I don't think there is a bigger, more important challenge to liberalism right now than to find a way to rebuild the labor movement somehow.
Do you have any ideas on this? Because it's pretty decimated and gutted. As you point out, the Walmart situation is terrible, you know?
Yeah, so part of the book I talk about, I have a sort of a narrative about the attempt to unionize a Walmart in Colorado, and, you know, the extent to which the deck is stacked against labor is not to be believed. It is literally true that nobody has ever managed to unionize a Walmart except for once,
yes,
when the meat cutters in someplace in Texas managed to get themselves declared a bargaining unit, and they voted to unionize. And what do you know? About a week later, Walmart said, we're not going to be cutting meat anymore. We're just going to be selling prepackaged meat. It is very, very difficult. There's an interesting idea that's been put forward by Richard Kallenberg of the Century Foundation. He says that you can't. Part of the underlying problem is simply a matter of law. I mean, laws favor management over unions, and the ultimate source of this is the 1947 Taft-Hartley law, which was really, it was passed right before the peak of the union movement, but it acted as a slow-acting poison on the labor movement, and so you need to roll back Taft-Hartley, and you need to revitalize the National Labor Relations Board. And Kallenberg's idea is, he says, look, nobody seems to really, it's been, you know, multiple generations since anybody really got very excited about workers' rights. So rather than frame this as labor rights, why don't we frame it as a civil right? Why don't we pass a law saying that it is a civil right protected by the Civil Rights Act to organize a union? It is actually illegal for a boss to fire somebody for trying to form a union, but the law is so weak that, as Kahlenberg says, it's actually economically irrational for bosses to obey that law. But if you were to extend protection of the Civil Rights Act, then workers would be able to take their bosses to court and sue them. And that might change the equation. That might help.
I agree with you, but unfortunately, as we saw with the healthcare debate, framing anything as a civil right creates a protracted battle and constant gridlock and endless concessions. And as you pointed out with this Walmart example, businesses are pretty much free to do whatever they want. If someone's going ahead and being an irksome worker, well, we'll go ahead and whack that part of our operations out. So, I mean, is there any hope for, I suppose, labor when you have legislation against them, and they also have this kind of anything goes unfettered approach from Walmart?
Sure, there's always hope. There's always hope. There was a time, but if you go back to 1932, things were looking pretty bleak then,
yes,
too. And we got a government that was pro-labor, and really the growth of labor unions was largely a result of the New Deal. So, government could make it happen again. It's very difficult in this environment, I will grant you.
Yeah.
There is a huge amount of demonization of labor. I was talking to a liberal economics writer the other day, and he was saying, problem with labor unions is labor unions in America, they have this culture that's so adversarial. And I said, culture? They're down to 7% of the private sector workforce.
Yeah.
You can have any culture you want because they're going to be starting from scratch.
Yeah.
So, I think there needs to be, as I say, it is the most difficult challenge, but I don't think you're going to see any substantial improvement towards equality without empowering workers. There's just no reason for bosses to pay workers a lot of money if they don't have to.
Do you think any movement that would actually amend some of these problems is not being adversarial enough? I mean, even Occupy Wall Street has to be careful because you have the police issuing all of these crazy regulations, as we saw with Liberty Hall a couple days ago. It's all, and now you have competing statutes of how they can protest the world's most exclusive club of 25, as we saw. So the question is, but they have to remain calm, which is totally unprecedented if you look at our history, if you look at bombs going off in Wall Street decades before. So, it seems maybe the economics writer you were talking to might in fact be right, that the problem is also cultural as well. Do you think that?
Well, you just need to be strategic about, the proper methods to use. I think there are certain situations where an adversarial approach is called for. There are other situations where a cooperative approach is called for. One thing that distinguishes Western European labor unions from American ones is they are more cooperative. They are part of a partnership, three-part partnership between industry and labor and the government. Walter Reuther, who is I think maybe the greatest labor leader who ever lived, was the president of the United Auto Workers in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. And he tried very hard to establish something like that European model here. And, it's fascinating. He was a brilliant man, and he was constantly proposing things to management that would actually help the company. He would say, for example, after World War II, he said, my workers will sacrifice some pay because we need to worry about post-war inflation. They will sacrifice some pay, but they have to see that management will show some restraint too by not raising the price of cars. And this was, this is a time when auto sales were oligopolistic in the United States. Didn't have a lot to do with supply and demand, so you could knock the price down of a car and still have plenty of profit. When Reuther would say, there's actually one instance, I can't remember if it was that instance or another one, where he was actually told, Walter, that's a really good idea, but because it's your idea, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, gotcha. Let's shift to the gender gap with higher education. There are, of course, more women who are now graduating from colleges and universities than men. You point out in a footnote, male college graduates still make about 16% more in their first post-college jobs than their female counterparts. You also state this gap would appear to be a legacy of the pre-feminist era. And I want to talk to you about this, because you also observe that despite the gender gap, the male median income has declined somewhat. So are there any hard economic projections on when this gender income gap will be closed that you know of?
No, it's just guesswork. But it, if women persist in being better educated than men, it's going to have to happen sometime. The difficult area will probably be at the very top, where some of the same weird testosterone-driven behaviors that probably hamper men everywhere else in the economy probably help them at the top. Just realistically speaking, I think that men are actually, especially middle and lower middle class men are really in trouble in this economy, in the post-industrial economy. Women seem to be thriving more, although, yes, it is also true that they are lagging behind men, and even lagging behind men in their first year out of college, which is a legacy of sexism. And, it's such an anachronism at this point. Women that age aren't even having babies.
Sure.
So I think that's going to have to dwindle.
What is the explicit connection between this gender income gap and the Great Divergence?
Well, women have actually largely exempted themselves from the Great Divergence. They'd be doing really well if they didn't have this unfortunate habit of wanting to create families with men. When we talk about this income, this gap in incomes, it's really driven by male incomes. First of all, male incomes are still at this stage dominant incomes in the economy, but also men have just been screwing up in the economy. They're not following the economic signals. They're not getting educated to the same degree that women are. And I don't really understand why that is. I mean, I think that's a fruitful area for sociologists to look into. It's kind of the full Monty problem, I think, of it as, sort of men just don't seem to be adapting very well to the new economic environment. But they're also not getting a lot of help. That's also true. And they could be getting a lot more help with labor unions, with more aggressive government intervention, and a number of other areas.
Let's discuss immigration. The New Republic, as you point out, once predicted that freedom of migration from one country to another was one of the elements of the 19th century liberalism that has faded to disappear. The foreign-born population of the U.S., it took a hit, dropping from 15% in 1910, 9% in 1940, eventually reaching 5% in 1970. Then Johnson comes along, he removes much of these caps. And then you see this rise in immigration largely from Asians and Latin Americans. Figures in the past have made the claim that immigrants drove down wages. Paul Samuelson, as you say, believes that the immigration caps contributed to the Great Compression, this period of prosperity.
Less wage competition from immigrants.
Exactly.
Right.
So I'm wondering, what are the positive effects that unskilled immigrant workers contribute to the economy? Can immigrants be entirely blamed for declining wages or this post-war prosperity?
No, immigration actually is a very small part of the problem. And really, the only area where you see any significant downward pressure on wages at all is among high school dropouts. And that's a pretty small group of people. And that's because the overwhelming majority of immigrants are Latinos who lack a high school education. Another thing about the immigration, immigration is kind of a moving target. On the one hand, you are seeing immigrants move more into unionized professions, in particular, meatpacking and construction. On the other hand, there are some early, it's very tentative, but there are some early tentative signals that immigration from Mexico, and Mexico is the single largest source, immigration to Mexico might actually be falling
on the way
off,
yeah, exactly.
Which is Now, it's not clear whether it has fallen off in recent years because of the recession.
But
it didn't fall off during previous recessions in the last couple of decades. And we know that the Mexican economy is greatly improved.
Yes.
You can worry about manufacturing in Mexico driving down wages in the United States, or you can worry about Mexican immigrants driving down wages in the United States, but I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense to worry about both at the same time, because to the extent that Mexican laborers stay in Mexico and work for industries there, there will be less immigration, therefore less wage competition.
The Mexican immigration decline fascinated me quite a good deal because, well, if workers' conditions or opportunities are better in Mexico and they're not inclined to come to the United States, that is something to give one pause. Did you find any figures for other immigrants coming in?
It's not a necessarily a sign of decline in the U.S. It's really a sign of improvement in Mexico,
yeah, exactly.
Which is something that I think anybody who's looked at the issue for, you know, this has always been the ultimate solution to this problem, is if people are leaving countries in Latin America to come to the United States because they can't make a living at home, you need to improve their economies at home.
Yes.
And that, in Mexico, it does seem as though there's, again, it's tentative, but there does seem to be tentative reason to believe that that's happening, and that's all to the good.
Yes. You checked in on Jim and Anne Marie Blentlinger.
That's right, the Blentlingers.
Yes, the subjects of Bob Davis and David Wessel's 1998 book, Prosperity.
Right.
You discovered
an ill-named book, but it's a great book.
Yes.
A great book.
Well, now it's the 21st century. The Blentlingers had only achieved upward mobility, as you say, by abandoning the private sector. So, now we're living in a time in which the U.S. Postal Service is collapsing. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are being put on the block. This was, at one point, a form of security for a lot of Americans, unskilled Americans. They can go into the Postal Service, work for life, and get a home and so forth. So my question to you is, if non-military government jobs represent only 1% of all U.S. jobs and the private sector isn't picking up the slack, then, well, are there any strong positive signs for upward mobility in the future, in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, if the government's not going to go ahead and pick up the slack and offer a more equitable arrangement for unskilled middle-class types?
Right. Well, I think the government should pick up some of the slack. And it is, you know, kind of heartbreaking that really the only way you can have the kind of standard of living that you used to be able to have working in private industry is by working for the government. It's just about the only way you can have a union, for one thing.
Yeah.
So, I was delighted to see that Jim Blentlinger had actually achieved greater prosperity for his family and was no longer representative of the dead center of the economy. That's great. But it's too bad, not too bad for him, but too bad for America, that at least in his case, that could only be done by leaving the private sector altogether. His wife was already a public school teacher. So we need to make the private sector provide opportunity to workers. And again, I hate to, you know, harp on this, but, you know, we need to revive the labor movement, and we need to improve educational levels. We need to make the economy share its prosperity more broadly. You know, for years, one interesting thing in Bob Davis and David Wessel's book is that they said that a number of economists were telling them that once the benefits of computerization really kick in, the productivity benefits, then finally you'll see a really dramatic increase in middle income wages. And you did actually see some of that increase in the late 90s when they were working on their book. But then it stopped.
Yep.
Actually, if you look at the last dozen years or so, the median income has declined slightly. What really needs to happen is workers do need to share. If there are productivity gains, workers need to see their incomes rise. This used to be considered something that happened automatically. It's not happening automatically now, but it does need to happen. And I think a big part of why it's not happening automatically is because there's no great reason employers need to. Their workers don't have unions. They're not the squeaky wheel. The squeaky wheel are their shareholders.
Yeah.
And so you've actually seen some shift, according to some studies done not by leftist economists, but by economists actually working on Wall Street, financial analysts working on Wall Street. There has been some movement of financial resources away from labor towards capital.
Yeah, but later in the book, you sort of put a sunny bow on the decline in upward mobility. We still have upward mobility, but it's not up there as it was in the 19th century, the 1950s, as you say. But upward mobility does continue to exist, and going up certainly beats going down or staying put. But, you know, if this is declining, I mean, it seems to me that we should probably take this a little bit more seriously rather than say, oh, well, we've got some. You know, it's almost like settling for the, well, the richest 1%, they are taking everything. We have a little bit of a slice here. So what of this?
Well, I didn't want to overstate the problem. I didn't want to say there is no upward mobility, because there is some upward mobility in the United States. What's true is there has probably been a decline in upward mobility since the 1950s. There's some disagreement among economists about that. It's either stayed flat or declined. I think I find slightly, in my research, I found slightly more people saying they thought it probably had declined a little bit.
Yeah.
But the real problem is that the United States now lags the countries of Western Europe. The United States used to be exceptional in its upward mobility compared to Western Europe, and now it's not only unexceptional, it's actually a laggard. One OECD study has the United States doing worse than every other country in the survey except for Italy and the UK. The UK is, in many respects, when you look at statistics about income inequality, you find the UK is virtually identical to the United States in a lot of these ways. Although, again, not as bad, particularly when you look at the income share for the top 1%. So, I'm not saying that things are great by any stretch of the imagination. But I don't want to overstate the problem either. I'm, you know, trying very hard to deliver very accurately what the findings are of mainstream economists on this issue. And there is a surprising amount of consensus.
This may be a bleak summation, but doesn't American exceptionalism have an ultimate lifespan? And maybe that's what we're experiencing right now?
President Obama would quarrel with you on that. That is, is America declining? Is it not declining? Who knows? I don't know. We still have a pretty powerful economy. I don't know. Obviously, there is no civilization that has dominated the world forever. So presumably someday we will pass the baton on to somebody else. But who knows when that will be? I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, based on the evidence so far.
Yeah. Well, to leave the question of whether the glass is half empty or half full to our listeners, Tim, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you.
Okay.